I want to tell you about a new investigative podcast called She Has a Name. It's about a young mother who disappeared in Detroit in the summer of 1987. She Has a Name tells the story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. You can search for She Has a Name in your podcast app.
This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with the show's producer, Kerry Jr. II. Hey, Kerry.
Hello, Stephen.
So how much do you think about the Constitution on a day-to-day basis, Kerry?
Let me think. 0 points.
Almost not at all.
No. It would be, you know, when we start talking and doing episodes about the Constitution, I realize, of course, more than I think just like everyone else would, how integral it can be to our lives.
It's,
I mean, I know it's
important.
An important document, but like, I'm not going around thinking about this. How many years, how many centuries old?
More than 200 years.
200 years old now.
Yeah.
Document. But I do think we've had conversations where you've opened my eyes to understand it in a different way, and particularly framing it around how it fits into our thesis, right? Because I think of our rights are our rights. It's a very government-based thing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, equality in some ways equals freedom. Freedom for everybody, not just one group or another.
Right. That's a different way of interpreting it that I think most people think of when they think of equality. But this intentionally highlights the significance of the Constitution as it applies to this show and this episode.
Yes. We're looking at the basic way in which our rights are respected and fulfilled under the Constitution and, of course, the Declaration, which is where we borrow the title of the show, Created Equal.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that the fulfillment of everybody's rights is an equality issue, not just whether some people have those rights and others.
Right.
It is about that, and we talk about that a lot, but it's also about the fulfillment of those aspirations. And that's how we get to today's guest, A.J. Jacobs, who's a journalist and author who spent a whole year trying to live the literal words of the Constitution, live literally according to the Constitution for a full year. And of course, his tongue is in his cheek a little bit here. He's being silly in some ways, but he's also being serious about how we think about those rights that were guaranteed in that original document, and how they're applied now, who they applied to then, who they apply to now, and whether it would even be possible to think of them in literal terms today. A.J. Jacobs, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Yeah. So you decided to live out a year according to the U.S. Constitution, to live by the Constitution. It's, I guess, an extreme iteration of the phrase, you should live your values, right? People say that to me all the time. So I want to have you explain what that means to live by the Constitution and why you decided to do it.
It's a great question. Well, a couple of years ago, I learned that most Americans have never read the Constitution, and I realized I was one of those most Americans. I had never read it. And yet, every day I'd read on the news how this 230-year-old document has a huge impact on how Americans live our lives, is still the center of a heated debate that's dividing our nation. So I thought, I want to not just read it, but really get inside it and live it, because that is the way I like to, as a writer, explore topics. I did that with the Bible. I wrote a book called The Year of Living Biblically, where I I followed all the rules of the Bible, the Ten Commandments, but I also grew a beard and the whole thing. So for this one, I said, I am going to follow the original meaning of the Constitution from when it was written. And that meant carrying a musket around the streets of New York where I live, writing with a quill pen instead of doing social media. And it was a weird year, I will admit. and my wife did
a little bit of the 1790s in the 2020s, right?
Exactly. But I will say, despite its weirdness, it was really enlightening, even empowering. And it really helped me wrestle with these questions. What did they mean back then? What should that mean now? How much should it evolve? How much should the Constitution be frozen in the past? And the bigger question is, how can we make sure democracy persists and is not threatened? So it was a fascinating year, despite my wife not enjoying us quartering soldiers in our apartment.
right. So did you literally quarter soldiers? The Third Amendment says you don't have to do that anymore, AJ.
Yes, that is true. I did not have to, but it does say in the third, first of all, it's the Third Amendment.
Yes.
Like this is number 3 of 10.
Yes.
Said that you Americans don't have to provide quarters for soldiers without their consent.
Right.
But I figured if I did consent, it's also my right to provide quarters. And
right.
I do. I think hospitality is a lovely thing. So I was able to find, it was hard. I asked a lot of soldiers. I asked some sailors in Times Square if they wanted to quarter in my apartment, and I got no takers. But I did find a friend of a friend, and he came over for a couple of days. And it was lovely to talk to him. And that was one of the great parts of this project, is I got to talk to people from all over and different views. And he was a very tidy soldier, so he made his own bed, and it turned out to be a pretty good experience in the end.
Yeah. So I'm going to want to talk a little later about the meaning of all this and what you learned from it. But I want to spend a little time talking about this year that you actually did this. I guess, where do you start when you think about, okay, I'm going to live by the Constitution as it was written and ratified in the 1790s? Do you start in the Articles, or do you start in the Amendments?
I started, yes, a lot of the behavior stuff is focused on the Amendments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you'll find bearing arms, which is why I went and bought a musket on ye olde internet and marched around Manhattan. The First Amendment has a lot. It's free speech, free exercise of religion, all sorts of things. But that's why I gave up social media and wrote much of the book with a quill pen. I also got a petition going, because that's in the First Amendment. I had a petition, hundreds of people who signed it, and I went to Congress to present it. I actually presented it to a sitting senator. And then there were parts that were a little weirder and unexpected, like in Article 1, Section 8, it says that you have the constitutional right to try to become a pirate, a legalized pirate, or a privateer is what the preferred word, which is basically the government would say to fishermen, you can take your boat and try to capture the British and keep their booty. And that's how we won the Revolutionary War, without them. So it's still in the Constitution. That's what's amazing. It hasn't been used since 1815, but I thought, it's time. Let's try it.
Yeah. So which parts were, I guess, the most unexpected or the most interesting to try to live out?
Well, there were good parts and there were bad parts. I mean, I did love writing with a quill pen, just because you are offline. There are no dings and pings and alerts to distract you. And I really think it changed the way I thought. I think I came up with better and hopefully deeper ideas. And I don't think everyone should, you don't have to write with a quill pen, but the general idea of writing either by longhand or completely cutting yourself off from the internet would be a great, I try to incorporate that even after my year, because I do think that we've, the internet has made us shallower thinkers. So that was a good part. There were parts that were quite awkward. And, you know, first of all, I did not love having a musket in New York, because I would get a lot of strange looks. People would cross the street. It did come in handy once, I will say that, which is that I arrived at a coffee shop at the same time as another customer, and he said, well, you go first. I'm not arguing with that.
That's right. I'm not getting into this fight.
Right.
So when you walk around with a musket, I guess, in New York, talk about how that feels. I mean, there are people who still today bear arms. That we have an argument about that, you know, going constantly in the country about where that's appropriate, where it's not, what kinds of weapons you should be able to walk around with. But talk about how that feels, and especially since it's a musket. I mean, where do you even get a musket these days?
Yeah, I bought it. You get it from the internet, like everything.
Like
it
everything
was,
else.
But this was an actual one from the 1700s. Well, it goes to the heart of the fact that the Constitution was written in the 1780s, when muskets were the main weapon of choice.
Right.
And how different that is from now, because I actually did go out and shoot the musket with some Revolutionary War reenactors at a shooting range. And it is such a different experience from shooting. I mean, first of all, it is 15 steps. You don't just pull the trigger. You have to pull out a ramrod, put the gunpowder in. So it takes a long time. So it would be very hard to do a mass shooting with a musket. So this brings up the big issue is how much should we focus on the literal words of the Constitution and how much should it evolve? So on one side, you have people saying, well, yes, all it says is that we have the right to bear arms. And that means any kind of arms. Mm-hmm. That's what they meant. And if you try to restrict it to certain types of arms, that's like saying, oh, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, only applies to stuff that you printed on a wooden printer in like Ben Franklin. On the other side, you have people who say, well, actually, the fact is that muskets and AR-15s are so fundamentally different that they shouldn't even be using the same word. It's almost an accident. So it's the same word. So it's almost like if there was a law that said wheeled vehicles, and at the time wheeled vehicles were bicycles and carts, and now wheeled vehicles are 18-wheeled trucks, do we want to change the law and say, well, maybe this is not a great place for Mack trucks to go?
Yeah.
So that was really the distillation of some of the big issues of having a constitution written in 1787.
Yeah. You also made your clothes and some of the tools that you need. I want to hear about that.
Yes, well, that was actually one of the joys of this is it was a much more DIY life. And I'm not a DIY guy. I'm not good at it. But I do see that we've become very estranged from the stuff we make. So the stuff we use. So I would get turkey quills, turkey feathers, and I would carve a quill out of them.
My goodness.
And then I would make the ink myself. So you knew where it came from. You knew everything. You knew all the ingredients in your life. And there was something very, very nice about that.
Yeah. So it sounds like a theme, I guess, for much of this was about how deliberate you could be. And in some cases, had to be about the choices that you made, that some of the convenience of the 2020s, which obviously wouldn't have been available in the 1780s or 90s, actually makes a difference in the way that you might think about the restrictions or the rights that exist and are protected in the Constitution.
Absolutely. It was a foreign country. And I don't claim to have gotten into the minds of the founding father. I tried, and maybe I got, halfway there, but it was, and it was living and using that technology had its pros and cons. On the one hand, I did like the quills because it was quiet. On the other hand, I was wearing their clothes, and I have never been so grateful for elastic in my life because I would put on these socks with no elastic, these wool socks, and they would fall down to my ankles. I'd have to put on sock belts. That's what every morning they would spend a minute putting on belts around their socks. So that is time I'll never get back. So yeah, I became grateful for many things. Democracy, first of all, right. But also elastic.
Yeah. Is there anything that just kind of jumped out at you from the year that you thought, okay, well, this is just ridiculous. I can't imagine how it ever could have made any sense.
Ah, that is a great question. Well, it was certainly, I was surprised by how different how fluid the ideas were at the Constitutional Convention. And all of these ideas that are rejected that we have never heard of, but if a few delegates had voted the different way, we in America would have three presidents.
That's right. That's right.
We would have, so it would be like Trump, Biden, and RFK Jr. working side by side in the Oval Office.
Or clubbing each other over the head, one to the other, right?
It's more likely. So on the one hand, I did think that this is ridiculous. How can they come up with it? But then you read more into it. The reason why they had this debate is because they were so afraid of a monarch. They are so afraid of demagogues and authoritarians. And so they were like, how can we restrict the power of the president? And this was just one idea. And when one of the delegates said, well, I guess we should have one president, many of the delegates said, no, that's the fetus of monarchy. That's just going to grow, and he'll become more and more powerful over the decades. And guess what happened? We have presidents, both Democrat and Republican, that have so much more power than the founders envisioned. And that became strange to me. So it's almost like the familiar became strange and the strange became familiar.
Yeah.
The fact that we are living in sort of a pseudo monarchy where the president issues hundreds of executive orders, has the power over war, which he was not supposed to have in the Constitution. It was supposed to be split between Congress and the president. Mm-hmm. That is a very bizarre situation to me.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the Constitution and a year of living constitutionally with A.J. Jacobs. Stay where you are. We'll be back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad that you joined us. We're talking with A.J. Jacobs, who is the author of a book titled The Year of Living Constitutionally, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Constitution's Original Meaning. We're talking about the Constitution, what it meant when it was ratified, what it means to us today, and whether we might ever be able to reconcile those two things. AJ, I want to start this segment talking about why you did this and what you drew from it. I mean, obviously, this is humorous, and I give you a lot of credit for the sort of whimsical approach to all of this. But you're trying to make some serious points about where we come from and where we are.
Absolutely, and one of the big themes is just what you said. With this was a document written in the 1780s, and it has amazing parts, and it did set up our country, but we are also, this is 230 years later, so mm-hmm. How much should we stick to the past, and how much should we evolve it? Now, what's interesting is now there's a movement called originalism,
yes.
which grew up in the 80s, became more powerful, and now 5 of the 6 conservatives on the Supreme Court identify as originalists in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they see the Constitution as the most important part of interpreting the Constitution is the original meaning.
The words themselves, yes.
The words, the text. Now, on the other side, you have, sometimes they're called living constitutionalists or pragmatists who say, yes, look at the text, but let's also look at how a Supreme Court decision would affect society, or how we've ruled in the last few decades. And so this has been, and it is, the Dobbs decision on abortion was because of originalism,
mm-hmm.
and the Bruin decision on guns has a lot to do with originalism, and the ultra-originalists on the Supreme Court, for instance, Clarence Thomas, would probably go even further if he can get people to join him. So I'll give you an example to make it concrete. The 14th Amendment says, promises equal protection and due process. But, and it was written right after the Civil War. Now, the people who wrote it, the original meaning and original intent had to do with protecting Black men after the Civil War who were being persecuted by white Southerners. So were those men thinking about women's rights? Were they thinking about gay rights or mm-hmm. trans rights? Clarence Thomas would argue no.
Yeah, they couldn't have been, really. I mean, those were not issues that looked the same then as they do now.
Exactly. So if you are a strict originalist, you say, well, the Supreme Court can say nothing about those issues according to the 14th Amendment. Maybe other parts, that should be voted on by the states. Whereas a more living constitutionalist or pragmatist would say, no, the 14th Amendment promises equal protection for all. And even if it only applied to one group then, now it should apply to all marginalized groups, women, gay people, trans people, whatever. So that is a huge difference in how we are interpreting the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. You have a chapter in the book called Race and the Constitution, and that's something else that we talk about a lot and argue about a lot. You know, there is I think a general consensus now that that the Civil War amendments 13, 14, and 15 fundamentally change the Constitution, almost are a second founding of the nation because of the way they change our notions of race and racial discrimination. Talk about how race affected the original Constitution and how that's changed over 200 and some years.
Right. Well, thank God it has changed,
yeah,
and
right.
that it still needs to change more. But the we have to wrestle with the fact that the Constitution was written by 55 white Christian men,
mm-hmm.
And some of them were slave owners. And so I talked to some great scholars of Constitution and race about this, and they told me about their two approaches you can take. I mean, there are more, but there are also two big approaches. Mm-hmm. One is to burn the Constitution, to say, which is the approach taken by the great abolitionist William oh my goodness, now I've forgotten his name. William Lloyd Garrison. Mm-hmm. William Lloyd Garrison, before the Civil War, he would literally burn the Constitution. He would go on stage and burn it in front of thousands and say, this is a pact with the devil because it has condoned slavery. Now, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist and orator and mm-hmm. thinker, at first he was on Garrison's side of let's burn the Constitution. But somewhere in the 1850s, he had a change of heart. And he said, instead of burning it, let's try to picture it as a promissory note. Mm-hmm. So it promises equality. It uses words like equality and freedom and liberty and general welfare. Let's make it live up to those promises and make America conform to what the Constitution promised us. Mm-hmm. And that is the language that I believe Martin Luther King used, and also Obama in his great speech on race. They both talked about how the seeds of liberty and equality and racial equality are in the Constitution, and the struggle is to try to make the Constitution live up to that.
Yeah, yeah. This idea of a more perfect union, which of course is the phrase that gets used in the preamble.
Right.
They seem to acknowledge that, hey, we're trying to be better. We're trying to get better. And that seems to forecast that that's not a singular exercise contained to one time. It's something we should be doing perhaps forever.
I agree. That's a great point. And they knew they had, as we discussed, huge flaws, mm-hmm. but they knew it was an imperfect document. George Washington wrote a letter to his nephew a couple of weeks after the convention saying, this is an imperfect document, and it's up to future generations to try to make it better. And they did include a mechanism to make it better, which are the amendments. And thankfully, we've been able to pass 27 amendments. But that's not a lot out of the 11,000 that have come to the congressional floor. And the problem is, I think if you talk to the founders, they would be shocked by how hard it is to pass an amendment now.
Yeah.
They did not foresee these two rigid parties that would that make it so hard, because you need 2/3 in Congress and you need 3/4 in the state legislatures to pass an amendment. So now we haven't passed one since the early 90s.
Right.
And I am worried we're not going to pass one for a long time. And this, to me, is one of the problems that we have to struggle with.
I think it's one of the it's kind of a great American paradox, right? I mean, one thing that I think contributes to the stability of the country and the fact that it has survived as long as it has intact is that it is really hard for things to change radically or quickly, right?
Right.
That there is this inertia that's kind of built in to the institutionalism that the Constitution sets up that makes it really hard to just kind of go and do something that is rash. On the other hand, the founders themselves talked about the need for constant change. And Jefferson at one point says, if any of this survives for more than 20 years at a time or something like that, then people aren't doing their jobs as
right.
Americans, that they should be rethinking it. And the tension between those two things, I think, is really interesting. I mean, there are times when we feel like things are moving too fast, I suppose, or some people feel like they are. And then there are times when we feel like, good gracious, it's taking forever to get us to a better
right.
space. Yeah.
That's such a good point. And yeah, and I think that's exactly it, the tension between flexibility and stability. And you look at other countries have chosen, France, for instance, has had, I think, 13 or 16 constitutions.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to balance those two. I do think we're too on the side of stability. It's too hard to change. And I don't think the founders would have approved. One of my favorite virtues that the founding fathers exhibited was this flexibility of mind. They would change their minds. Mm-hmm. And you don't see this in politicians today. My friend Ben Franklin, who is my favorite of the founding fathers, he's got his own flaws, but overall, he's pretty good. And he said, or more than pretty good.
he's pretty good.
yeah, he's certainly better than me.
Mine is Rufus King. And I've always kind of idolized him. I mean, he was such a strong abolitionist that I've always kind of, tacked toward his thinking. But Franklin was
that
right
is
up there.
Great. Yeah. Well, Franklin was in I think he founded an abolitionist society
towards the
end. He had an enslaved person for some of his life.
He did.
So that's not.
He did.
But he said during the Constitutional Convention, he said, the older I get, the less certain I am of my own opinions. And he told this lovely little story about, he said, there's a French lady who said to her sister, it's so curious, so strange. I'm the only person I've ever met who is correct on every issue in the world.
On everything.
Yeah. And his point, of course, we're all the French lady. He was very aware that we all have this bias to think that we're right all the time, and he fought against it, and he liked to change his mind. And that is something I would love for politicians and just Americans like me to get back to, that changing your mind, it's not flip-flopping, or it's good if you have new evidence or you see a new way of thinking about it. Change your mind. That should be rewarded, not punished.
Well, it's one of the great problems we have with social media too, right? Everyone is expected on social media to be absolutely perfect in what they say and how they think. And there's almost no space for rethinking, because then you get attacked, right? Well, you said this before, and you know, people pull out old quotes and out of context and say, well, you once said this. And it's like, well, I did. But I've been thinking about it, and I've been talking to people, and I think differently, and there is a built-in just intolerance for that right now.
Oh, yeah. I love that. And two things occur to me when you said that. First is, at the convention, they specifically did not record the names of people in their votes.
Right.
Because they wanted them to be able to change their mind without people saying, oh, you're a hypocrite. So that they built that into the Constitutional Convention. The second thing is, at the time, Ben Franklin's newspaper came out twice a week. And I tried to replicate that in my own news consumption. And it is, I mean, you should, of course, listen to this show every day. But other than that, you should, I think, being fire hosed with these negative stories 16 hours a day is really bad for our mentality and our psyche, and having a little distance where you can think of solutions and say, look at the big picture, and only getting your news in, whether it's half an hour a day or, you know, twice a week seems a little radical, but an hour a day. And then cut yourself off. You don't need to know every time Biden goes up 0.3% or point down 2%.
Yeah, well, guilty as charged. I mean, I'm looking at the feed on Twitter constantly, especially in an election year. I don't seem to be able to look away.
Well, it is also your job. So
it is my job. It's always my excuse, right? All right, we need to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with AJ Jacobs about the Constitution. Stay with us for more Created Equal. Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined. We're talking with AJ Jacobs. He's written a book called The Year of Living Constitutionally, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Constitution's Original Meaning. AJ, people just don't know enough about this. And, there are things that people believe are in the Constitution that aren't there, and there are things right. that people believe aren't in the Constitution that are. And I would imagine that living that way for a year would have reminded you of some of those things.
Exactly. And John Roberts, who I don't agree with politically, but he said, everyone talks about the Constitution and no one reads
it. No one reads it, right.
And I think there is some truth to that. The majority of Americans have not read the entire U.S. Constitution. I was in that majority, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
And so when you read it, my hope was to get a crash course, and that's what I hope the book does also, is give you a little crash course in what is in the Constitution. So when a politician says, well, it's not constitutional to go fly a kite, or whatever they try to claim, that you have a little more knowledge that you can say, well, let's take a step back and say, what did it really say?
Yeah, yeah. So let's go through some of the things that you realized or learned during this year. One of my favorites is about the joy of festive voting, that it was really different in early America when Election Day arrived. It was a celebration, and we've lost that almost completely from the tradition.
Well, I love you bring that up. That was one of my favorite themes. Now, we don't want to go back to 1700s voting because it was women were not allowed to vote, sure, and Black and Indigenous people were barred from. So that, of course, is terrible. For the privileged few who could vote, however, it was, as you say, much more festive. This was a new right, the first time that people had the opportunity to choose their own leaders. And it was a sense of awe. And I wouldn't say it wasn't quite Coachella, but they did. They had music. They had, rum punch. They had farmers markets. You would make a day of it. You had the day off. And they had election cakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I focused on election cakes because I was like, we can do this again. Australia has a democracy sausage, I believe it's called. They have huge barbecues in their voting day. And I'm like, let's get back on that. So I started a movement using Facebook, which I know is not 18th century, but I got hundreds of people around the country last November to bake cakes in the celebration of democracy and bring them to the polls and remind people. Our catchphrase was, democracy is sweet. And let's remember that and fight to increase democracy. We're not going to leave it where it is. We've got to improve it and make it more accessible. But let's try to celebrate it so that it's not seen as something, some chore you have to do, yeah, like going on jury duty.
Well, I mean, you think about other things we celebrate and other festive events and how big a role food plays in nearly all of them. I'm a big fan of New Orleans and have been to Mardi Gras several times. I mean, the food that is at the center of Mardi Gras is one of the reasons it's so much fun. You know, everyone wants to have King Kank. and that just, it adds this levity to the whole thing.
I love that point. I hadn't thought.
So
about
I love
that.
Your election cake. That's we gotta.
Well, join. I'm doing
that.
It again in November. And I will say, there was a great study a few years ago where they did try to set up little festivities at various polling booths, and it increased voter turnout. So it is, in one sense, a silly thing, but it's also, I mean, it might have a real impact,
yeah,
and it'll maybe get us thinking about how to increase democracy in other ways.
Yeah, yeah. You talk in the list of things that you learn from this also about looking beyond the founders for the people who have shaped the way we live now and shaped our aspirations in some ways. The people who framed the 14th Amendment, for instance, people
yes.
like Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells, they get left out of some of the histories, but you think they should be more prominently remembered.
Yes, absolutely. I think the founders had some great ideas, but it didn't end there. And thankfully, we are not the country that we were in 1789. It has been a constant state of struggling to increase democracy for other groups and make it, as you pointed out, a more perfect nation. So there are people who say that when we say the word founders, maybe let's not stop at those guys who were at the convention in 1787. Maybe we can have a more expansive version of who are the founders. They're people who have helped to found new ways of looking at democracy. And those people you mentioned are perfect. Mm-hmm. Frederick mm-hmm. Douglass, Ida B. Wells, and so many others. And it continues today. Like, you know, you could say maybe when we engage in talking about the Constitution and fighting to make the America better, we are, in our own way, founders.
Yeah, yeah. I also was struck by this kind of revelation that we're too polarized now. And by that, you don't mean that we have too many opposing sides, that we have too few, right?
Yeah.
James Madison thought there would be lots and lots of factions that defined American politics, and we've settled really firmly, I feel like, into this two-party system where anyone who's outside of that really is an outsider and doesn't have much chance to have an effect on policymaking or decision-making. You note that, look, we could have – there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have two
right.
parties. We could have a lot.
No, it's a huge problem. And there was a new book. So after, hopefully, you read my The Year of Living Constitutionally, if listeners are interested, they might pick up this book called Parliamentary America, which argues just this. We should have more of a parliamentary system where we have – I think the Goldilocks number is between 4 and 8 parties that represent different aspects of society, because what we have now is so rigid. And first of all, you have people like in the Republican Party or in the Democratic Party that have vastly different views. And a lot of the issues seem to be unrelated. For instance, why should owning a gun or free enterprise have anything to do with abortion? Mm. Those are not necessarily morally related. So, and what the problem is, it makes it so hard to change. And the founders would have been appalled. Mm. They would not have liked, as you said, Madison wanted, he knew there were going to be factions, but he thought there'll be lots of them. It's a big country. They'll have like 100 factions and you'll have different alliances and shifting alliances, and you'll get things through that the people want. That has not happened. Now we're stuck with two. And even adding to the problem is now that the Senate has the supermajority
sure.
requirement,
yeah.
meaning you have to get 60 votes to pass any real legislation. Again, not in the Constitution, and not something. And Madison went on the record as saying this is a bad idea when it was brought up much later in the 1800s. He said this is going to make it so the minority is holding the majority at hostage. You don't want the tyranny of the majority where 51 people can just run roughshod, but also this supermajority creates another problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a lot of what you're pointing out in terms of that problem and some others, you know, they are things that Congress could fix, or that the people ourselves, we could fix. But I wonder what you make of the Constitution itself and the fact that we haven't passed amendments in a really long time. If you could think of amendments that, I don't know, might make things better or things easier, what kind of amendments should we be even considering in America in the 2020s?
Oh, well, I love that question. I have tons of ideas.
But, I was not surprised.
And they're not all mine. They're out there, but there are so many that could make our democracy just more functional. And I do hope we find a way to do it. One is to make voting a right.
An explicit right,
which is not in the Constitution. I also think the founders would be shocked that Washington, D.C. has 700,000 people who are not properly...
They're not in part of any state, right?
And yeah, which means they have no senators and they have one sort of a lame congressperson who can't really do anything. It's like just sort of a ceremonial position. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. 700,000 people. That's like, that's not much less than was at the start of our country. So the fact, and this was all part of a weird compromise that they made in the first Congress, where they were worried that if the government were part of one state, mm-hmm. then that one state would have too much power. But the result is 700,000 people who are not represented. That needs an amendment, yeah. in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. You also say the Supreme Court is far too powerful.
It
was the least powerful branch originally. I mean, it is the shortest part of the articles, right? It's the shortest article. Article 3 is nowhere near the size of Article 1 or 2, which established the presidency or Congress. But the court is now the central actor, really, in so many of our political dramas. And that happens because the court kind of, assigns to itself all kinds of things that it can do. But you feel like that's just gone maybe a little too far.
I would take out the maybe.
Not even maybe.
I think it is, to me, a crazy situation that we have the Supreme Court, as you said, was the third of three. It was definitely the runt of the litter. It was not considered to be an equal to Congress or the president. And yet they are making, these nine unelected people are making decisions that affect millions of lives in a very real way. Where we can go to school, what we can carry, what we can do with our bodies. Mm-hmm. And the founders, I think, most of them would be shocked because in the beginning, they did like the idea of an independent judiciary that weighed in on constitutional issues, mm-hmm. had some say. But you talk to historians like Jonathan Gnat at Stanford, who's great, and he talks about they had a say, but the president and Congress also had a say. Yes. It was sort of a joint decision. And the idea that what we have now is not just judicial review, it's judicial supremacy, mm-hmm. where the court is seen as the ultimate and final arbiter. What they say goes. And that is just crazy because it is, as I say, nine unelected people. And I think there are various ways to rein in the Supreme Court that we need to do. 18-year term limits is one. Teddy Roosevelt had a radical idea that maybe is not a great idea, but he said, if there's a decision that comes down, say it's Dobbs, that most of America disagrees with, you could have sort of a vote, an election.
A referendum,
right. And overrule, voters could overrule the Supreme Court, which would be crazy. Like, imagine that, that there's checks and balances, and we are the balance on the Supreme Court. So something needs to be done, because as you say, I do believe it's out of control.
It's too much. Okay, last question. Okay, you've done this with the Bible. Now you've done this with the Constitution. What's next?
It is a great question. Well, I will say, I don't know if this is family friendly, but some readers say that I should try to be the do it with the Kama Sutra and try to be the best lover in the world. And my wife had no interest in that, and neither do I, to be honest.
Well, there are worse aspirations for sure.
But okay. Yes, I need to take a little break from this and do something. That does not require muskets or beards.
There you go. Okay, AJ Jacobs, it was really delightful to have you here with us on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I love the conversation. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for all you do.
That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.